Let's take our Bibles. We'll go to Exodus chapter 21.
Titled the message, Transitioning from Slavery to Stewardship. That's what God's doing with His people who'd been slaves for, we don't know exactly how long. We know it happened after the Pharaoh who was on the throne during Joseph's time had passed away. There came a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph, didn't understand what those people were in his land. They'd been slaves for centuries at this point. Exodus 21, we're going to start in verse 33, and we're going to read down through chapter 22, verse 15. When a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restoration. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead beast shall be his. When one man's ox butts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price. And the dead beast also they shall share. Or, if it's known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has not kept it in, he shall repay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall repay five oxen for an ox, and four sheep for a sheep. If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. He shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it's an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. If a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed over, or lets his beast loose, and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and in his own vineyard. If fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that the stacked grain, or the standing grain, or the field is consumed, he who started the fire shall make full restitution. If a man gives to his neighbor money or goods to keep safe, and it's stolen from the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God to show whether or not he's put his hand to his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it's for an ox, for a donkey, for a sheep, for a cloak, or for any kind of lost thing of which one says, "This is it," the case of both parties shall come before God. The one whom God condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. If a man gives to his neighbor a donkey, or an ox, or a sheep, or any beast to keep it safe, and it dies, or is injured, or is driven away without anyone seeing it, an oath by the Lord shall be between them both to see whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. The owner shall accept the oath, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it's torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn. If a man borrows anything of his neighbor, and it is injured or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. If the owner was with it, he shall not make restitution. If it was hired, it came for his hiring fee. Now, didn't that warm your heart? Let's see if we can make some sense of this morning. When I was in grade school, I remember this great trade that I made with a kid in my class. I think it was in fifth grade. We'd worked through the multiplication table and so on, and he had this little pencil box, and it had a little slider, and it would line up the numbers. So 3 times 8 equals 24, and we'd have the answer in a little window. And you didn't have to work and remember your multiplication facts. You could just use your little pencil box and slide this handy little gizmo down the box, and it would give you the answer to your multiplication facts. I thought it was great. It was not your ordinary little pencil box. It was something rather unique, rather cool. I placed a high value on that pencil box. I wanted it. He was the only kid in school that had one of those. But I knew I could get it for something that it wasn't worth. In the end, I ended up trading my fruit roll-up for a pencil box. I thought that was a great trade. Okay. As we come to Memorial Day, what we do, what we celebrate, is our nation's values. All of us have values, and the whole purpose of Memorial Day is to place value on what is most valuable. In the United States of America, we especially value our freedom, because we know that freedom is never free. Freedom comes always at a great cost. We value our freedom because we value the cost of our freedom. It came at the price of lives. It came at the cost of blood. Somebody else's blood was shed so that you and I can roast our hot dogs and hamburgers tomorrow. Somebody else's blood was shed so that you and I can meet in this church and worship in freedom today. Somebody else's blood was shed so that we can own the property and drive on the roads that we enjoy in this great nation. Always at the forefront of any culture is what they value. My very first vehicle was this 1974 Datsun. It was as ugly yellow as that is. We named it, I didn't name it, my boss named it, the Banana. He laughed at me coming down the street. He said, "Weberg, that thing's a banana." It sounded stupid. I paid all of $400 for it. And then I think the U-joint went out on it the next day. Ended up paying another $100 for that. But the Banana. Now, this was my car my senior year. For whatever reason, we tend to place value on the things that we have. We start to identify ourselves by the things that we own. We know we shouldn't do it, but we do. And so I remember after getting that truck and it's sitting in my driveway, and it's no taller than my dad's little Dodge Aspen. I mean, the thing, they both look like cars. I remember standing back and trying to pretend that looked tough. I just couldn't do it. It came up just above my kneecaps, and I would crawl in that thing, and the heater on it wouldn't work before I got to school. I'd have to be scraping the insides of the windows. In fact, I forgot that. It just rolled down the windows and stuck my head out in the middle of winter to try to see my way down the road so we could get to school. Hey, my next car was a little better, if you're a grandma, all right? A 1980 Thunderbird. Mine was baby blue. Ugh. It had those nice spoky tires. This is a Thunderbird. And again, I'd try to stand back and, yeah, that's a grandma car. I just, try as I would, I could not get it to look or feel cool. And my value, my pride, my self-esteem was wrapped up in my corny car. When we come to the Mount Sinai, we remember that God is forging a covenant community. He's got some 2 million by some counts, between 600,000, which was just counting the men, up to maybe 2 million people are there on the plain before Mount Sinai. And God is speaking to all of them collectively, but he's meaning for all of them individually to hear what he has to say. And we know that in the Ten Commandments that he was laying out for this community, their core values of holiness, understanding that they are tied to a holy God and they are a holy people who serve this holy God. Understanding that grace is at the very core of their fiber, of their relationship with this God. In the fourth commandment, that one day out of every seven, you rest in what God does for you and you can't do for yourself or for your God. And then numbers 5 through 10, six commandments that focus on what it means to be a covenant community, what it means to be individuals tied to a holy God in context of living together. Love, holiness, grace, and love are at the core values of this covenant community. What we see as God is laying out for them some laws regarding property and wealth is that as a holy people, they will never be defined like their God by their giving until they cease to be defined by their having. They have God, and in that they were to rest. Now, they're still receiving an inheritance from God when they move into the promised land. They're going to have houses that they didn't build, cisterns that they didn't dig. They're going to have vineyards that they didn't plant. They will have stuff. And when they get the stuff that God is giving to them, God is laying out rules for how it is that they're supposed to be related to their stuff. But when push comes to shove, at the very core values of their community, they could never be defined as such by their stuff. Stuff is just stuff. And it uses that word, I think, up in verse 8. When somebody gives to another one of his neighbors some of his stuff, it's just stuff, but keep track of the stuff that you're entrusted with. A holy people will never be defined by their giving so long as they're defined by their getting or their having. And God is trying to reconstruct their whole identity. For some centuries now, they've been slaves. They've had nothing. Everything that they have had has been in the employ of one who has taken everything from them, demanded everything from them, and used to build glory for somebody else. Not in a context of love, not in a context of commitment, but a context of survival and slavery. Now they're being given stuff, and God's telling them how to use it. When we come to this text this morning, this is more of a topical sermon, if you will, and I don't mean for it to be that, but as these case laws are being laid out for us, there's principles that permeate all of them. And to go through each one individually and say the same thing and look at all the distinctions, that's why they had men who functioned as lawyers within their society. And God gave these case laws with the intent that they would do just that, that they would carefully compare this case with that case. What we want to do this morning is try to take some of the larger principles from these case laws and look what God is doing with regard to their wealth. And I think we'll find that there are three insights that God provides for his people into the nature of ownership itself. The first is this: ownership includes both the privilege of having and the responsibility of doing. Well, it's pretty much tied up in what it means to be an owner. We find the word for the first time used in this way up in Exodus chapter 21 in verse 34. When a man opens a pit, when a man digs a pit and doesn't cover it, an ox or a donkey falls into the pit, then the owner of the pit makes restoration by giving money to the owner of the ox. The word owner there is the word Baal. You might be familiar with the term Baal. The word Baal simply means ruler, lord. It can mean husband. It has the idea of owning something and having the rights to control it. And so an owner is something who has something in his possession and is able to rule over it, is able to decide what is done with it. This is the idea of what it means to be an owner. But as God lays out for his people, our attitude towards possessions is more important than the possessions themselves. In Proverbs chapter 30, it's the wisdom literature of Israel, a man who's simply known as Agur is quoted with regard to having a proper attitude toward possessions. This book of Proverbs is laid out for young men who are in the court who are gaining a biblical worldview, a God-shaped worldview. And they quote Agur as saying this: "Remove far from me falsehood and lying. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. He says, God, I don't want so much that I forget about you, but at the same time, I don't want so little that I feel that I have to provide for myself by taking from somebody else. God, just meet my needs. And that was built into the wisdom literature of Israel. But as even before that, Israel is warned by God against an improper attitude toward their wealth. Up in the book of Deuteronomy, just before they get to go into the promised land, God speaks to them and says this, "Take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his rules, his statutes that I command you today," Moses says, "lest when you've eaten and are full and have built good houses and you live in them, when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, all that you possess, all that's in your power to control and rule, all that's in your domain and dominion and kingdom." When all of that gets bigger and you get too big for your britches, then you forget the Lord your God because your heart is lifted up. "Beware lest you say in my heart, my power, the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it's he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers, as it is this day." When it comes to possessions, I need to have a very careful attitude toward them, walking this delicate balance between, God, don't give me so much that I forget you, and God, don't give me so little that I think I have to provide for myself. I think we often find ourselves here, God, don't give me too little. How many of us actually pray the prayer, God, don't give me too much? Anyone pray that here recently? I don't think so. But that's a delicate balance. And the issue isn't so much the possessions as it is my heart toward those possessions. The warning is extended in the New Testament. Paul writes to Timothy and says, "Timothy, as for the rich in this present age, I want you to charge them not to be haughty, not to be lifted up, not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but to set their hopes on God, who richly provides for us everything to enjoy. They're to do good and be rich in good works." And then get this, "Having riches, they should be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so they might take hold of what is truly life." My attitude toward the stuff that I have. There's a warning both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that stuff that I have can cause my heart to be lifted up because I'm defining myself by the stuff that I have. Ownership includes the privilege of having. But in the midst of my having, I have tied hand in hand with it the responsibility of doing. All of us are familiar, especially as parents, that with privilege comes responsibility. We say that over and over again to our kids. With privilege comes responsibility. With the privilege of having comes the responsibility of doing something with my stuff. My responsibility with regard to my possessions primarily extends to God. That's why a couple different times in this context, when there comes a question about stuff, it says in verse 8, "The owner of the house shall come near to God." At the end of verse 9, "The case of both parties shall come before God." Verse 11, "An oath before God or by God shall come between them both." God is the context in which all my stuff is possessed. Therefore, my responsibility with regard to my possessions, my stuff, primarily extends to God. Philip Ryken reminds us, "The Bible assumes that people have a God-given right to own and possess private property, but that property is meant to be used for God's glory, and that's why it's wrong to take it away from another person." God gives me stuff not just for me to enjoy. It's mine to enjoy, but it's not just mine to enjoy. It's mine to use for the glory of God. It's mine to meet the needs, to meet the responsibilities that are mine, and to invest in those that I'm responsible for, and also to meet the needs of others that God says I'm actually responsible for, beyond my immediate circle and responsibilities. Because the stuff that I have doesn't ultimately belong to me. It belongs to God. Because who gave me the stuff? God gave me the stuff. Even when I work hard to get the stuff, who gave me the strength to work hard? God gave me the strength to work hard to get the stuff. Stuff that I have really belongs to me, but it really belongs not to me, but to God. So in Deuteronomy 16, God makes this provision. He says, 3 times a year, all of your males shall appear before the Lord your God at the place that I'll choose. Feast of unleavened bread, feast of weeks, feast of booths. Now listen to this. They shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every man shall give, and here's what he has to give, as he is able. What does that mean? I'm leaving that up to you. Every man must give as he is able according to the blessing of the Lord your God that he has given to you. The stuff that you have because God has first given it to you. That means God has a claim to all your stuff. You ever have stuff that gets broken? You ever have stuff that gets taken? You ever have stuff that gets worn out? Well, sure we do. Who's in charge of all that stuff? Well, I am. Who's ultimately in charge of all that stuff? It's really God's stuff, isn't it? So I try to take care of God's stuff so I can use it the way God wants me to use his stuff the right way. My responsibility with regard to my possessions primarily extends to God, but secondarily it extends to others. Walter Brueggemann writes, these laws suggest that one must control even his own means of production, the ox, in order to guard the well-being of his neighbor. The danger to which some of these laws, this one in particular, points is a disregard of the neighbor because he's preoccupied with his own interests. We cannot conduct our lives in disregard for our neighbors. So as I'm using my stuff to meet the needs of my family, to work the responsibility that I've been entrusted with, I'm not just focused on me, but I'm watching out over my stuff to make sure that my stuff doesn't hurt my neighbor and his stuff. Because God's given my neighbor stuff that's meant to be used for God's glory as well. And so I can't get so focused in my having stuff and using stuff to get more stuff that I lose sight of my neighbor and their needs and this context in which we live together before God. A second insight that God gives us as he's shaping the perspective on ownership is that ownership implies potential for both profit and loss. Now as we work through these different laws here, these property laws in this chapter deal basically with 4 situations, outright theft, negligence, safekeeping, and then borrowing. I'm just going to walk through these real quick. Back in chapter 21, a man who opens up a pit or digs a pit, if he doesn't cover it and an animal falls in, he makes full restitution, but he can keep the carcass of the dead animal. That is, the consequence of this animal falling in the pit, he has to take a living animal and give to the owner, but he gets to keep the dead carcass. Not going to do him any good. But the whole point is that the one who's responsible for it incurs the whole cost of the responsibility of the accident, because he was the one who didn't cover the pit. Down in verse 36, if it's known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has not kept it in, then he needs to repay an ox for an ox. Again, he's negligent in his responsibilities. His ox has gored something in the past. Now it kills another ox by goring it. And he didn't take responsibility for keeping it in. He was negligent in taking care of his stuff so that other people's stuff didn't get hurt because of his negligence. He needs to bear the full responsibility of it. It says, he shall repay ox for ox, but the dead beast can belong to him. Here's the point. As God's setting up these rules, I'm responsible for other people's stuff. Even when it's my stuff that hurts their stuff, if I'm negligent in taking care of my stuff so that somebody else get hurt, I incur the loss. But I don't incur more than the loss. God is very gracious in the way that he puts this together. He says, listen, the dead beast belongs to the person who paid the price, who suffers the damage. In the middle, verse 35, when one man's ox butts another so that it dies, they shall sell the live ox, and they will share its price. And the dead beast they shall also share. So here's an accident. It's not negligence. This ox decides to do what oxes sometimes do. It gores, it butts, it kills. There was no way of knowing. It's never done this before, but it did it this time. It was a legitimate accident. It was mine, but it happened to kill yours. So what do I do? Well, I could just give you the whole ox or repay the ox, but I wasn't being negligent with it. By the way, what was your ox doing in my field with my ox? Okay, besides that, okay, here's what God says. It's an accident. Part of the live ox, the sales of that live ox will go to me. Part of it will go to my neighbor. And that dead ox, we'll cut them up. The meat will feed both of our families. So I don't incur as much of the loss as I would have otherwise. And he doesn't incur as much of the loss as he would have otherwise. There's a balance. There's a fairness in what God's setting up. In chapter 22, we come to the stealing laws. If a man steals an ox or a sheep, and then he takes what he's stolen, it didn't belong to him, but he assumes property rights, he kills it. Now he can't give it back. He kills it or he sells it. Again, he can't get it back. If he does that with something that doesn't belong to him, if it's a means of making money, like an ox, he has to repay five times what he stole. Man, that's a heavy-duty burden. If it's just something like a sheep, you're not making money on it, but you're depending on it for wool, for clothing, for food, four times. If it's a money maker, it's five times. If it's a life maker, it's four times. You have to restore what you took. Interestingly, the Bible gives a provision up in the book of Leviticus, and again in the book of Numbers. It says, now, if any man will confess that he stole something, he doesn't have to pay four times or five times. He just pays it back, and he adds one-fifth of it to whoever he stole it from, acknowledging that he shouldn't have done it, but he's willing to make that restitution by confessing and taking care of things the way he should. You come to the New Testament, there was a little swindler. He was smaller than most people. In fact, he crawled up in a sycamore tree just so he could see Jesus. Jesus says, hey, I'm coming to your house today, Zacchaeus. He goes to Zacchaeus' house, and everybody in town knew he was a sinner. He was a tax collector. He was a thief. He would skim off the top. He would add more that was required to their taxes so they could fill up his pocketbook. He says, you know what, Jesus? Your coming here has changed my life. I'm going to give back half of what I own. I'm going to give to the poor. And whatever I've taken from anybody, I'm going to pay them four times as much. The law only required, if he's confessing himself as a thief, he needed to pay one-fifth as much as what he took. He said, you know what? I'm going to pay 400%. rather than 120%. Because God, you've changed my life. Stuff doesn't define me anymore. It's got no hold on my heart because Jesus, you've got hold of my heart. The idea of restitution as it's developed in this section has the idea of shalom, of bringing peace, of bringing that balance, of restoring health to the community. And as you move through this, God is giving these laws and the restitution in order to rebuild relationships within the community. See, inherent in this theft is the idea that I don't have enough. And so I'm willing to jeopardize your welfare in order to benefit myself. God says, listen, you can't build a community on holiness, grace, and love if you're so wrapped up with stuff that you're even willing to take it from other people in order to benefit you while hurting them. That's why verse 2 and 3, if a thief is found breaking in and struck so that he dies, there's no blood guilt, but the sun rises on him, there shall be blood guilt, but he will surely pay. If he has nothing, he'll be sold for his theft. Okay. This guy is breaking in, and the idea is tunneling through. It's probably a mud brick house. He's tunneling through the house. You don't know what weapons he's bringing. You don't know his intent or purpose for coming in. It's dark. You bean him over the head with a baseball bat. He dies. Tough luck for him. He shouldn't have been tunneling through your house in the dark. Same thing happens in the middle of the day. But you can see what's going on. You can see what weapons he has. You can see maybe who it is. Well, then you can't just bean his brains out. You've got to try bring it to the courts. You bring it before the elders. Bring it before God. And he must repay. You've caught him. You've caught him in the act. You've caught him red-handed. Okay? But he didn't get away with it. He didn't take anything. But interesting what it says there, verse 3, he shall surely pay. That is, even though he wasn't successful in his attempt to take something, he owes all that he intended for the other one to lose. God says, let me get this across to you. You cannot benefit at somebody else's expense. Right, we got that. We don't get that. We don't get that. When we're kids, we don't get that when we're adults. We don't get that when we work for somebody else. We don't get that when we own our own business. We don't get that when we're deacons. We don't get it when we're pastors. We don't get it that we're not supposed to benefit off somebody else's coattails, okay, by taking from them. God says, I want you to understand, I am the source of all you need, and I am the source of all you have, and I've given you, in fact, more than you need so that you can take care of others. The stuff that I give you, I want you to hold it like this with hands wide open so it falls through. That's how I want you to hold your stuff. We're reading the life of A.W. Tozer right now. And he used to give back half of his salary back to the church. Drove his wife crazy because she had to go out and get jobs to put meats on the table and try to figure out how to feed his family. But he, in trying to follow these principles, actually harmed his family irresponsibly. But when it came to stuff, he didn't want it to have hold of him. And so he let go of it. You think of others who've given all of their stuff away. And who was the guy who had the orphanage, and he'd pray? George Mueller. Giving away all of his stuff and banking on God from day to day to day to meet his needs just for today. That's why Jesus teaches us, Lord, give us this day our bread for the year. That's how I pray. God, why don't you give me today what I'm going to need for this whole year? And then maybe for the next decade, and I'll be a good steward. I'll invest it for you. Why? Because stuff has a hold of my heart. and I want to plan and bank just in case God doesn't. I wouldn't say it like this. Just in case God doesn't come through. You ever think like that? You don't. I do. Like, I'm more responsible with stuff than God is, who's given me all my stuff in the first place. We can keep on going through these laws. We don't have time. I want to get to this third one. Ownership indicates the deepest values of community. And that's what God's getting at with all of these different laws. He says, folks, stuff can't have such a hold on your heart that you're willing to hurt those around you. Stuff can't have such a hold on your heart that you're unwilling to trust me for your needs. Stuff can't have such a hold on you that you place more confidence in your stuff and you base your identity on your stuff rather than basing your identity on me. When it comes to stuff, Brueggemann writes, this series of laws reflects a patient struggle with the most mundane matters. An ox butting an ox. Taking somebody's this, losing somebody's that. How we know who's responsible for what? But it's precisely in these mundane matters that the health and the well-being of a community is gained or lost. You know what? You can only build trust in a community when the community understands that I'm not out to fleece the community, but I'm out to invest in the community. One of the things that we've done well in America is building a consumer culture. That's how our culture runs. We build something, we sell services because somebody else wants it. We'll trade our services for their cash, and it's part of a good economy. But our economy has done something to the way we think, that everything is governed by having a little bit more. It's governed by what I have. It's governed by what I want. Even our church culture is not so much in this church, but other churches, American churches, were governed by a consumeristic attitude of, what's in this group to benefit me? We don't have a very big youth group at this church. Guess what? The consumer mentality says, what does your youth group look like? Oh, it's not very big. That doesn't benefit me very much, so I'm going to go somewhere else. Rather than, I'm going to stick around here and add my child to this youth group, so when the next person comes, there'll be a little more youth group to have and to share with others. This consumer mentality of what can I get from others to benefit myself? God says, listen, at the heart of all of this, ownership will indicate what is the true value of your society. Does stuff hold your heart? Or are you so freed from stuff that you're willing to give stuff to meet the needs of others? I look at the numbers of this church, our attendance, our offerings, our sacrificial offerings, and I say, how in the world can so few people reach into their pockets and come up with such numbers? It's just incredible. This church doesn't love stuff. Well, not entirely, because all of us do, way down at the heart. But you know what? God has worked in your hearts, in your lives, to value something more than stuff. I'm thankful for this church because you've proven over and over and over and over again that stuff doesn't hold your heart. But be careful, my friend. As we come especially to Memorial Day and we realize that sometimes a community requires not just the giving of our stuff, but the giving of our lives. You know what? A holy people will never be defined by living, especially to a gravestone. if we aren't even willing to give up our stuff? Do we have a generation that would be willing to lay down their life for others? 1 John 3:16, we read it this morning. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. You know what effect that should have on us? We should lay down our life for others. And the very next verse, he says, here's what it needs to look like. If anyone possesses this world's goods, and he sees a brother in need, he needs to let go of his stuff. That's what it means. That's what it looks like to lay down my life for my brother. Jesus says, listen, by this will all men know that you're my disciples. Stuff. I don't know where you struggle with that today, if you struggle with that today. But if you're living and breathing, you're probably struggling at some point with stuff wrapping its tentacles around your heart. Everything you have comes from God. Everything you have is meant to be used for God. Investing in your responsibilities towards your immediate family, your immediate needs, but also looking for ways to invest beyond your immediate needs. I think of the McCann's needs that we've had recently. And there have been deep pockets and large offerings, and you've met those needs. That's how we're supposed to be using our stuff, because it's not about us. It's about reflecting a God who gives, and it's not about what we have, because we have everything when we have him. Let's pray.